Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome everyone to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm Katie O'Connor.
Yes, that's right. Our intrepid John Michael McGrath is on a well-deserved break, so producer Katie O'Connor is pinch-hitting this week. We hope we've got a good lineup for you on this podcast, including the price tag now in on the cost to municipalities of COVID-19, and it's astonishingly big. And we've got an Ask Us Anything segment, where we'll answer your On Poly questions. It's Tuesday, December 15th, 2020, so let's get to it.
So we know COVID-19 has cost municipalities a ton of money through lost revenue, but until last week, we didn't really know just how much money we were talking about there. So the Financial Accountability Office of Ontario did the work of crunching the numbers for us. And for those of you who missed our interview with the Financial Accountability Officer of Ontario, Peter Weltman, the FAO is a nonpartisan agency which reports to the Legislative Assembly, not to the government of the day. So these numbers are truly independently arrived at, not influenced by politics and all the shenanigans that go along with that. So what kind of damage are we looking at?
Well, Katie, frankly, it's huge. The FAO estimates municipalities across Ontario have and will take a $6.8 billion hit over the 2020-2021 years. That's everything from fewer people riding buses and subways and streetcars. So obviously revenues for transit systems are way down, and many of us have been under lockdown, so obviously recreation, culture, those kinds of activities, they're down as well.
Well, that's the revenue side. What about the spending side?
Obviously affected too. Cities and towns have had to spend more on things like temporary housing and homeless shelters, public health, family services, including, of course, long-term care facilities.
And they did get some financial assistance, though, right? The government didn't leave them high and dry.
No, that's quite true. The province of Ontario stepped in with $4 billion, which included money from the feds, through a program we've talked about here before, the so-called Safe Restart Agreement. So that no doubt helped. But that money only goes for 2020 and the first quarter of 2021. So once the spring is over, unless everything magically springs back to the way it was, the financial pressures are going to return and we'll have to see what transpires after that.
You know, as a producer, I usually don't like to inundate people with numbers, but I think in this case, it helps to really complete the picture. What else jumped out at you?
Well, you're right. Let's not inundate people with numbers, but let's leave them with just a few so they get a better understanding of this. And let's start in the capital city region. For example, the Greater Toronto Area municipalities are seeing a 7.5% revenue drop. That's $4.6 billion over 2 years. I repeat, $4.6 billion over 2 years. Now, remember, over the last decade, municipalities have seen their revenues grow, on average, by 3.8% a year. So when we say revenues are taking a 7.5% drop, it isn't a drop from zero. It's a drop from whatever the normal rate of growth would be. In other words, it's way more dramatic than even the numbers would suggest.
That is a really massive drop. Has the Ontario government indicated at all whether there will be another influx of cash for cities?
Well, not specifically, no. But we do know that the Finance Minister, Rod Phillips, when he introduced his budget last month, he did put in there a contingency fund of more than $3 billion. And that's essentially a rainy day fund, which he will spend on whatever priorities come up at the time. So, yes, it could go towards helping municipalities. Or not. You know, we'll have to see as next year arrives.
All right. I'm going to change gears here a little bit. So we put out a call last week for listener questions about Ontario politics, and we got a lot of really good ones. And so, Steve, you're going to start us off?
I am indeed. Okay. Let's see where we're going to start. Let's start with this one here from a fellow named Gord Young, who tweeted at me asking this question. What effect does Biden have on Ontario? Okay, Katie, you looked into this. What do you think?
Yeah, well, so you could approach this question from a few different ways, but I'm going to look at this from a trade perspective with the caveat that it's probably too early to tell, but we can look at a few different things. I'm going to focus in particular on steel and aluminum tariffs because, hey, I live in Hamilton now. Steel town, right? Got to represent. So, but In all seriousness, though, these really were a sticking point in Canada-U.S. trade relations under the Trump administration, and they have a major impact not only on jobs here in Ontario, but the price we pay for things. And Steve, do you remember June 1st, 2018, you know, a millennium ago?
A millennium ago? Katie, I've told you 1,000 times, don't exaggerate. It was only a year and a half ago. And yes, of course, now that you and I are both Hamiltonians, we remember it well. It was a bad day for Canadian steel, and I think you're going to share all the details about that.
I am. And, you know, Steve, I was working from home with a toddler for 5 months. Believe me when I say I am not exaggerating. It really was a millennium ago. Anyways, that date was when Donald Trump imposed a 25% tariff on imports of Canadian steel and a 10% tariff on imports of Canadian aluminum. And they did this under Section 232 of the U.S. Trade Expansion Act, which they can do if something is deemed a threat to U.S. national security. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any U.S. president had ever done that before. Am I right?
Katie, actually, I don't think any American president has considered Canada a national security threat since the War of 1812. After we burned down the White House, I think we've been pretty good friends since then, up until this administration.
Well, one of the good things is that Canada did eventually negotiate its way out of those tariffs, but it's always been kind of this thing hanging over our heads, particularly here in Ontario. And now I'm going to try and read the tea leaves a little bit. Joe Biden, he ran on a campaign of emphasizing Made in America policies, particularly creating new manufacturing jobs. But will he go as far as using Section 232 like Donald Trump did? Who knows? But it's probably safe to say that steel and aluminum will continue to be a trade focus between the U.S. and Canada. Whatever happens, the impact of those decisions is going to be felt directly here in Ontario. So that is a very long-winded way of saying we don't know.
Well, let me throw my own little 2 cents here on this. It's quite ironic that most Canadians, when you ask them, would always tell you we'd prefer to have a Democrat in the White House. You know, if you look at the polls from this time, I think Joe Biden was the preference of 70% of Canadians compared to maybe 30% who wanted Trump. I think when Hillary Clinton ran 4 years ago against Donald Trump, it was more like 80-20. Anyway, that's the way it tends to be. And yet, ironically, Republicans tend, in the past, before Donald Trump, Republicans tended to be more for freer trade than Democrats. Democrats were always more protectionist. So Canada tended to do better on trade when a Republican was in the White House than a Democrat. That, of course, has been blown to smithereens under Donald Trump, who very much changed the focus of the Republican Party. So I think your "we don't know" is actually quite accurate, because we don't know whether Joe Biden's going to come in and be a kind of a typical Democratic protectionist, or whether he will be more open to more trade with Canada. We shall see. Okay, let's move on here. I got another one. I got this one on my Facebook page, and it says, Waterloo Region is experiencing massive growth and is in dire need of 2 more full-size hospitals. The province's growth plan projects the region will reach a population of 742,000 by the year 2031. What is the province doing to expedite this desperate need? Katie, you want to take that one on?
Yeah, so we actually put this question to the Ontario's Ministry of Health, and they responded saying population growth is just one of the considerations they use when determining whether to build new hospitals. There are a bunch of other factors like demographics and demand for services in the region, and they said it's actually up to the hospitals themselves to bring forward proposals for new infrastructure. And those proposals get brought forward to the local health integration network, who then brings it to the ministry. So it's a whole sort of chain of events that needs to happen.
Yeah, there is a process in place. And are there any plans in the works at the moment to build new hospitals in the region?
Currently, no, according to the ministry. However, they did outline some expansions they are undertaking to several hospitals in the area.
Okay, that was a question on my Facebook page from Morgan. This is from Libby from Twitter, who writes, will large corporations be able to purchase the COVID-19 vaccine? How will government stop this possibility in the future? Good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this probably relates to some reports last week that the NHL was attempting to privately purchase a COVID-19 vaccine for their employees.
And I bet those reports went over really well with the public.
Yeah, exactly as you'd imagine. People were furious. And, you know, for what it's worth, the NHL quickly sent out a statement saying they were interested in securing a vaccine when it was available for private purchase, but they, quote, would not jump the line to do so. But, you know, getting back to Libby's question about whether governments will intervene, the Federal Health Minister, Patty Hajdu, was asked about this on Friday.
We don't have any mechanisms to block corporations from purchasing on a private contractual basis with corporations around the world. Listen, these are individual corporations that are selling to a variety of countries and selling to a variety of actors. I don't know the details of Pfizer's, for example, corporate contracts with other countries, but I will say this, anything the government of Canada procures for citizens will not be sold for a fee.
Again, for what it's worth, the head of Pfizer Canada came out over the weekend saying the company is prioritizing selling to governments ahead of private corporations. And okay, it's my turn now. This is from Tarek over Twitter, who is writing about the public and Catholic school boards in Ontario. And he asks, what will it take to merge school boards?
Aha, I think the answer to that question is either an astonishing bit of political courage or political foolhardiness. Katie, one of the truisms of Ontario politics is that there is and always has been a very toxic mix of education, religion, and politics. And I'll just take you back to two of the most famous examples that have happened, say, over the last 35 years or so. In 1985, former Premier Bill Davis announced that he would extend full public funding to the end of high school for the Catholic school system. Remember, at that time, it was only funded, I think, to the end of grade 10. And then if you wanted to stay in the Catholic school that you'd been attending, you had to pay tuition for grades 11, 12, and 13. Mr. Davis got up and said he was going to extend it all the way to the end. And you know what? Even though that measure passed in the legislature by a vote of 129-1, there was a considerable amount of grumbling in the public about it. And the Tories went on to lose the next election. Mr. Davis left, Frank Miller took over, and the Conservatives ended up losing power after that 1985 election. The next most recent and best example was probably in 2007, when John Tory, now the mayor of Toronto, but then the leader of the Ontario PC Party, had it in his platform to extend public funding to so-called faith-based schools. And again, that was extremely unpopular with a big chunk of the electorate who seemed to be saying, no, we don't want more money going to religious schools. We actually would prefer you to take money away from religious schools. Many were thinking of the Catholic school system there. And Mr. Tory, unfortunately for him, led his charges to a rather dismal appearance in that election, and Dalton McGuinty won his second consecutive majority. So the lesson has seemed to be since then, leave it alone, don't touch it. And that's why, in the answer to the original question, when are the public and Catholic school boards going to merge into a single unified governance system? I'm not looking for it to happen anytime soon, Tarek, I'll tell you that.
Do you think that's changing, though? I mean, like, as you mentioned, it was kind of like the political third rail. Like, you didn't go there.
Yeah, you touch it and you got killed. That's right. Is it changing? My sense is that if it's going to change in any direction, it's going to be an attempt to take money away from a religious-based school system as opposed to extend funding to more religious-based school systems. I know that it's the case in many other provinces in the country that public funds do go to Jewish school systems, Seventh-day Adventist school systems, Muslim school systems. I know all that's in place. It's just never flown in Ontario. And we know, for example, the Green Party, Katie, has run in previous elections with a platform of defunding the separate school system and unifying the school governance systems. But of course, the Greens only have one seat, so they're not in a position to do that. And it has not been a part of the platform of any of the major parties at all.
All right. Good to know. This is, I guess, our last but not least question. This is from Jillian over Twitter, who writes, quote, how did omnibus bills come to be and how can we get rid of them? She is clearly not a fan of omnibus bills.
Well, just for those who don't know, an omnibus bill is basically where you throw everything but the kitchen sink into a bill. You know, usually you would like a bill to be about one thing. You know, here is a bill to outline or to outlaw spitting on the sidewalk, or here is a bill to extend funding to the separate school system. You know, that's a bill. But it has become more common in the last, I'm going to say probably 25 years, for governments that have a lot of unpopular things to do to throw them all into the mix. In a way, you kind of overwhelm your opposition by throwing everything into the mix all at once. So you might have something in one bill that deals with education and healthcare and the courts and jails and, right? Maybe 10 different things in a single bill or 20, and none of them necessarily having anything to do with one another, but it's a way of kind of dealing with a bunch of different fires all at once. I think the first big omnibus bill that really became controversial was back in 1995. Mike Harris was the Premier of Ontario. He brought forward an omnibus bill, which, again, had everything but the kitchen sink in there. The Liberals, who were in opposition at the time, were really very much opposed to this, and they staged a long filibuster, even to the point of one of their MPPs named Alvin Curling, who would go on to become a speaker in the future, staying in the legislature and refusing to leave, including... Well, how do I put this? This is a family podcast. He didn't even leave the legislature to use the facilities, Katie, if I can say that. All of his fellow MPPs would gather around him and put up blankets, and he had to relieve himself on the floor of the legislature because the minute he left, his filibuster would be over and the bill would go through. So he didn't leave. That was the first big omnibus bill that got through. And the reality is governments do them mostly because they have majorities and they can. In the end, the omnibus bill went through. The federal Liberals in this parliament have brought forward omnibus bills in the past, or I should say over the last 5 years that the Liberals have been in power federally. So it's happened at both levels of government. And to get back to Jillian, I understand why she's not a fan of it. Most people are not fans of them because it seems like it's a way to try to sneak in stuff under the cover of other things. And for that reason, opposition parties don't like them. Journalists are concerned about them. Special interest groups are concerned about them. But governments love being able to tackle a whole bunch of things all at once with a little bit of bait and switch and sleight of hand. How's that?
That's great. And I was going to say that is a real dedication to the democratic process, relieving yourself.
Yeah, I remember that quite well, actually. And once Mr. Curling found out that he'd have to actually stay in his place in the legislature in order to make the filibuster work, and he couldn't leave even to go to the bathroom, you're right. That was a whole new dedication to the craft. Anyway, that was something. That was different, that's for sure. Well, thanks to everybody who sent in a question, and apologies to those that we couldn't get to. Anyways, we always like to conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll do that for you immediately after we ask you, as we always do, to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. You can let us know what you liked or what you didn't like and help us make this show a little bit better.
If you'd like to send us a comment, shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org or tweet at us. I'm at @KA_O'Connor. That's @KA_OCONNOR.
And I'm at S. Paikin. That's SPAIKIN.
Subscribe to the On Poly Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
And here now is my quote of the week. Now, you'll remember a couple of weeks ago, Premier Doug Ford was very unhappy with the Auditor General's report on how he handled the initial government response to COVID-19. And Ford essentially told Bonnie Lissick she was too far out over her skis, she had engaged in mission creep, and she should stick to finding inefficient spending and keep her nose out of everything else. Well, last week, this year's annual auditor's report came out, and guess what? Premier Ford was singing a very different tune.
I love this report because, you know, this gives me the ammunition to sit down with the OPS and to be very frank, my ministers and deputy ministers, and run through the concerns. This, in my opinion, this is a great report. Now, I've out of the 45 pages, I've finished off about 20 pages. It's a pretty in-depth report, but I'm going to follow up with every single minister, and there's some great stuff in there.
There's Doug Ford, perhaps more reminiscent of his days as a Toronto City Councillor, watching how government spends taxpayers' money.
So I'm going to break the rules here a little bit. What I've chosen isn't a quote, but rather a moment. It's the first COVID-19 vaccine, and the vaccines arrived in Ontario late Sunday night, and yesterday the first person in the province, a woman who is a personal support worker at a long-term care center in Toronto, received the very first dose. And just to give you a picture of what the scene looked like, she and a nurse are seated in the middle of a really large, kind of empty-looking room, surrounded by doctors and photographers who are all 6 feet away. You can hear like the clicking of the cameras, and she closes her eyes as the nurse administers the vaccine, and here's that moment. So if you didn't pick this up from the audio, one of the doctors in the background says, "The shot heard round the world." And it's just one of those moments that, you know, if you think about all the things we've been through this year, and you and I talk about that in this week's On Poly newsletter, you know, we go through our top 10 Ontario politics moments. But I have to say, it is truly amazing to me that scientists were able to come up with a vaccine for a virus that is entirely new to humans and only, you know, became known to us just under a year ago. So, you know, I just wanted to end things on a positive note.
That is indeed quite inspiring. And considering that most vaccines take years or even decades to discover, this is really an astonishing achievement, as long as it works. We'll, of course, stay tuned. And incidentally, Katie, did you see the size of the needle that goes in?
You know what? I did not. I did not look at that. I'm not a big fan of needles.
Well, I don't know anybody who is, but I'll tell you something. It isn't the little tiny flu shot needle. That's a good size needle. So let's hope this damn thing works. Anyways, that was episode 92 of the On Poly podcast and our last one for 2020. We're back in the new year with more episodes. We are produced by the estimable Katie O'Connor, who pinch hit for our lovely and talented John Michael McGrath this week. We want to congratulate Matthew O'Mara for his editing wizardry. We're thankful for research help this week from Kara Stern. And, of course, to Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell, who always provide super helpful admin backup. Katie, to you and all of our listeners, as my dad likes to say, you want to say it or should I say it?
I don't want to take your line from you. You say it.
Okay. Okay, everybody. Stay positive. Test negative.
See you next year, Steve.